This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
While the world whizzes by, enjoy a moment of me time with Tim Horton's $6 breakfast bundle. Savor a small hot or iced coffee, then add your choice of a mouth-watering hot breakfast sandwich and a crispy golden hash brown and your pick of a classic donut.
Yeah.
All for $6, all just for you. Make your mornings all about me time with our $6 breakfast bundle. Available at your neighborhood Tim Hortons. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is the last intermediary episode before I resume the narrative. Woohoo! Woo! But please hold your applause. There is still a third part of the AMA in the works, but I am pushing that forward to the next big break since I couldn't record around the 4th of July fireworks here in the US. Anyway, this episode is intended to act as a bit of a primer for the next phase of Persian history. So, today I am joined by Derek from the Hellenistic Age podcast, because who else would be better for explaining to us what exactly this new nightmare we are entering into on the history of Persia is going to look like than somebody who talks about it all the time?
I've spent 6 years of my life doing this. I'm preparing you for the inevitable onslaught, so you're going to join along in the punishment with me, but at least you have somebody to follow on this end.
Dear God, are we 6 years into this?
You
started only a couple months before me.
Yeah, we're pretty close in that. And the fact that you're actually closing the gap on me is frightening, but then I realize, oh wait, you still have all that other stuff to cover before me. You're not even done with Alexander yet.
You got a couple months from the time we're recording this to the time I actually finish Alexander. But I'll start gaining on you again eventually, because I don't care about the Ptolemies.
Oh, but everybody likes the Ptolemies, especially the Ptolemies.
You know, it's funny that we make that joke about them, because it's not like the Seleucids weren't sleeping with their siblings.
Well, you know, of course not. I mean, but it took a little bit longer before they started buddying up. I mean, their family tree was pretty expansive, not like like a family bonza or a family ladder that became the Ptolemies from basically day one. I mean,
it's true. All of the outside DNA in the Ptolemy family tree is Seleucid.
I mean, there's a reason why if you look at a coin of like Ptolemy the First and then 300 years later, you still see the same chin and nose in Cleopatra and her father. It's kind of disturbing if it's not propaganda. So I just the idea of it's like a Habsburg. I mean, nothing really that we can see was wrong with them. But I mean, you look at some of those rulers, you're like, oh, I kind of wonder.
Yeah, I mean, the Seleucids supposedly managed to keep a birthmark hereditary for generations, which is at least as concerning. But these names probably don't mean anything to a solid percentage of my audience, because we are just about, when this episode comes out, starting on the Hellenistic Age, as you call it. And that is the period of chaos, insanity, reassemblage, and recollapse that follows in Alexander the Great's wake. And it is called that because it is a period of widespread Hellenism across Western Asia, Egypt, and the surrounding regions. And Derek, I have one important question for you to get this started. What the hell is Hellenism?
That's what I ask myself almost every time I pop an episode up. But, I mean, you did a pretty good job summarizing the period. I mean, the term Hellenistic is entirely modern as an amalgamation. And by modern, I mean mid-19th century. A German scholar by the name of Johann Gustav Droysen came up with it to describe this period from the death of Alexander the Great until the eventual death of Cleopatra the Seventh and the absorption of Egypt into Roman Empire, as overseen by the Emperor Augustus. primarily from its conception, it's focused on the supposed one-way direction of spread that Greek culture went from. So after Alexander the Great's conquest, we have the establishment of several Greek dynasties from Macedonia all the way to Central Asia and even parts of India eventually. There we allegedly see the transmission of Greek culture and intellectual life, be it in the way of literary culture, aesthetic values, language. Obviously, there's a lot more complications to this term nowadays. We have a lot more evidence, and we come out with a different perspective than someone from the mid 19th century would. But that is a term of convenience, and oftentimes one we would just stick with. There are technically even the bookend period of Cleopatra is more of a matter of convenience, because there were still technically Hellenistic kingdoms, if you want to call them that, till the beginning of the new millennium. So it's definitely one of the most fascinating periods for me. I mean, everybody in school terms, you're going to be skipping over it. You'll maybe cover classical Greece from the time of the Peloponnesian War, maybe Alexander the Great, and then jump straight up to Republican Imperial Rome. But that's a period of 300 years that's affecting a large portion of the world. So this, trying to encapsulate this into a nebulous, we do see there's a lot more complications in regards to the intermixing of Greek culture, but it is that prominent fixture point for the entire period, where it is the elite intellectual culture for much of the world. And I think keeping it as that terminology is simple, and I'd rather just stick with it for the sake of convenience for me. I can't tolerate anything else like the Macedonian centuries, like some people have tried to pitch.
Well, and even would put far too much emphasis on Macedon than it deserves. You might get a couple of royals who are Macedonian, but they are adopting Greek culture pretty heavily already by the time you get to Alexander, let alone anywhere after that. And you certainly can't call little tiny Iranian breakaway states Macedonian, but they're certainly taking on Greek elements.
For sure. And the whole blurring the lines of what is Greek and Macedonian not entirely fades, but quickly gets resolved when many of these kings are establishing themselves over a predominantly non-Greek population, be they the Seleucids, who oversee probably the most diverse empire. And actually, that's a good time to step back here. So the Hellenistic world, for most part, is dominated by three major powers. There are the Antigonids in Macedonia, who have replaced the dynasty of Alexander the Great, the Argeids. In Egypt and parts of North Africa and the Levant, you have the Ptolemaic dynasty, its most famous member being Cleopatra of Julius Caesar and Mark Antony fame. And then lastly, the Seleucid Empire, which controlled the lion's share of Alexander's Asian conquests, roughly covering Asia Minor all the way into Mesopotamia, Iran, Central Asia, and that is the breadth of it. It's an enormous empire, very diverse. But there are several of these breakaway kingdoms that establish themselves both immediately after Alexander's death and during the period as it goes along. Some key examples being the Attalid Kingdom of Pergamon on the western coast of Asia Minor. There is also the Greco-Bactrian Kingdom in what is now modern Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, lots of parts of Central Asia, but also some more Iranian establishments such as the Kingdom of Armenia, the Cappadocians, Pontus, and there are many, many smaller minor lords, which I could spend all day naming off of, but that is the broad framework. And we see this basically form the map for well over 150, 200 years before you have the inevitable rise of other states such as the Roman Empire, the Parthian Empire, and then the collapse of these dynasties into fractious infighting or being outright conquered in the case of Macedon, for example.
Good. And for my audience, keep those Seleucids in mind. They will be the ones we follow around as they start by beating everybody else up and finish by being kind of pathetic.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, I think Seleucids of all the dynasties, of all the major powers I cover, the Seleucids are for sure my favorite. But man, they really... They really do not want to stick around. They somehow stick like a weed, but they really are so self-destructive by the middle of the second century that it is actually surprising they lasted as long as they did.
Yeah, they are a strong example of the higher the rise, the harder the fall. And we will be sticking with them on this show from the time that they pop into existence down until they lose control of Ekbatana, which is my official designation for you've lost the right to be in charge of the history of Persia. But this does raise a good question, because when this episode comes out, my audience will be coming fresh off of Alexander the Great. And it does raise the question of what led to all of this competition and just outright animosity between Alexander's successors, the Diadochoi, to use Greek. Up to this point in my show, they've been mostly friends when they weren't trying to assassinate Alexander themselves, and fighting in a monumental war to take over the world together. And in about 45 minutes of an episode from now, they will tear it all apart.
That's a great question, and the story of Alexander is perhaps one of the most spectacular in all of ancient history, but let's just say that as much of a brilliant commander as he was, and I do believe that, his ability to build an empire, not so much, to put it mildly. Essentially, the long and short of it is that as soon as Alexander had died on June 10th or 11th in 323 BC, fighting literally broke out immediately between nobility and the cavalry and the infantry. That is just but a taste of what was going to eventually expand into a 40-year-long series of wars fought between largely the same group of men, those who primarily served under Alexander, but also the generation right afterwards. You have famous figures, of course, like Ptolemy, the Seleucus. Later on, you have famous figures like Pyrrhus and Demetrius Polyarchides, the taker of cities. Their infighting, you could see that before Alexander died, there was clearly issues. I mean, rivalry between them was already prevalent. For example, Hephaestion, Alexander's best friends and likely Eromenos, was not particularly liked by many of his contemporaries. He famously had an argument or a feud with Eumenes of Cardia, one of the later other successors. And there was a lot of competition that it depends on how we view it in retrospect, because most of the chronicles about Alexander's life are written oftentimes by men who had vested interests to paint themselves in better lights. Famously, Ptolemy of Egypt wrote a series of memoirs that was borrowed on heavily by the likes of Arrian, who is probably a name you've heard quite a few times in your discussion of Alexander. Arrian famously claiming that Ptolemy's not going to lie. He's a king. The kings don't lie. Well, okay, Arrian, I'll take your word on that. But
coming from the history of Persia, I'd like to present every time I've mentioned the word behistun.
Well, there's certainly some bending of truths here, but we know that there was clearly some sides that were more self-interested than others. Ptolemy, for example, basically took Egypt as his own personal fiefdom right out of the gate. He had the previous satrap murdered, allegedly on grounds of corruption, which was probably true, but he quickly just divided the piece of pie and wanted nothing to do with anybody else for the time being. This was in flagrant disregard of the leading official Perdiccas, who was technically Alexander's official. But Alexander's own had failed to produce a biological heir. I mean, he technically had one son, but at the time of his death, he was only a fetus in the second trimester. They had no idea if it was going to be a male heir. So that doesn't really lend a lot of confidence to the line of succession, putting any child on the throne, never mind one who's not even born yet. So these men were brilliant. And Alexander, a testament to his skill and leadership, and I think this can be applicable to figures like Augustus or even Justinian of the Eastern Roman Empire, or Byzantine Empire. The skill of the men that he gathered was extremely impressive. These were some of the most brilliant minds or tactical general minds of the day, but they were super ambitious. I mean, this is a repeated phrase in the historiography. Men that would, I think Justin has a great line, the epitome from Pompeius Trogus, describing as one of the best collections of men the world ever produced. But they decided to destroy each other instead, rather than create a united front. And a lot of this was entirely opportunistic. Clearly, there was a lack of central support in either Macedon or in Babylon, which became Alexander's capital. As I mentioned, there was no male heir to really assert authority. So the army relied on, the army was supportive of Alexander's half-brother, Philip Aridaeus, who was unfortunately not a good choice either, because he was either afflicted with some sort of mental condition such as epilepsy, or maybe he was special needs of some capacity. Either way, it was clear that he was not fit for rule. And all the surviving Argeids became pawns in the political games of these successors, and one by one were murdered, ending really with the death of Alexander's son, Alexander IV, and his wife in approximately 306, give or take, if don't quote me on that. And that's when everybody kind of gives up the facade that, we're all kings now. You know, we take everything by the spear. This is all by conquest. But that's really how Alexander was functioned. He took the Persian Empire by the spear. This is another form of legitimacy, even though they aren't really connected to the Argeids. And some of them did try to confirm that link to the royal family. It eventually became not irrelevant, but certainly less important than displaying that military prowess, having the funds and resources to wage war and declare yourself the master of whatever territory you like to carve out. Be it Seleucus taking over Babylon, be it Ptolemy taking over Egypt. So it really is a case of just incredible ambitious men using the instability of the time, a lot of it Alexander's direct fault, and just taking it and running with it. And unfortunately, that might actually speak quite a bit, where you have these so-called friends of Alexander, when really it might be more described as, you know, court members, and these loyalties can turn on a dime when presented with the carcass of the Persian Empire and all the treasures that lay within it.
Yeah, that is one thing that I probably haven't pointed out often enough, is that when we talk about people being friends of the king, in Persian context, that is uniformly a political position. That is something you are appointed to become, is a friend of the king, a table made of the king. And then the Alexandrian sources are always interpreted, or at least translated, as, well, they were great school buddies who grew up together. And it's like, I went to school as a 16-year-old too. If we'd been trained to use spears, there are kids I would have used a spear on. Like 300 BC? Seems like that's how it works. Or you're Cletus the Black, and that's how it works in the other direction.
And that is a good point, where Alexander, you know, had these incidences throughout his reign where he did assassinate several of his, or, you know, you can use the word assassinate in the case of Parmenion and Philotas, but also the unintentional drunken murder of Clytus, as you mentioned. But clearly Alexander had his moments where he was willing to, you know, take action at needed fit. I mean, being a king, you know, you need to break a lot of eggs to make his omelet. And not only for the peoples he conquered, but amongst his own staff, he did have these instances where they had to be executed. Of course, there were times where he made poor judgment and did not execute people that probably deserved it, such as Harpalus, his treasurer, who stole thousands and thousands of talents worth of silver for his own personal embezzlement, gave it up, forgave him, and then somehow he got caught doing it again, which is insane to me, because that's like, you know, somebody embezzling billions of dollars and being like, oh yeah, you're my buddy, let's get this over with. But then, you know, it's really a competitive environment, and there was no tolerance for any sort of wavering loyalties. And that was also an element of Alexander's rule, especially with regards to, say, his adoption of Persian customs. That was a big point of contention with many of his Macedonian and Greek staff members. And so whether he was poisoned by his own party men, I cannot say. I don't personally believe that. But the fact that so many people in the ancient world arguably came up with that theory, it doesn't speak much to Alexander as the connection between Alexander and these so-called friends.
No, I don't think poison did him in the end either, but it's, you know, it wouldn't have been the first time. If he was assassinated, it was attempt number 4 or 5. Like, it wouldn't have been a surprise to anybody. Now, we're spending a lot of this time talking about the men who would go on to rule these breakaway empires, which is how the sources are written about them. But I do want to get back into what the process of Hellenization was and what did that actually look like on the ground, because it's easy to just look at a kind of lofty, elevated ruling class that comes from another land and be like, well, obviously they have a different culture. That's how the Persians were to most of the people they ruled. But Hellenization changed everything for everybody. It kind of jump-started the existence of recognizable cities in Iran, for example. So what was the Hellenization process for the average person on the ground?
So for the average, you know, your average day-to-day laborer or peasant or someone living in a village, the effect, as far as I can learn, is that life did not change too much. I mean, you still had the same sort of policy, you know, day-to-day, your religious rights were not infringed upon. You did the same, you participated in the same festivals and ceremonies. The person who you pay taxes to was different, and as was the military arm of the kingdom you lived in. If we use that for the example, a case study may be a good one for the Ptolemies. I mean, granted, their scale of taxation certainly changed, but in a lot of the countryside of Egypt, you had these, life went on. Clearly, though, for example, local languages like Egyptian in Egypt or Aramaic in most of Western and Central Asia continued to be used even in administrative circles, as was certain religious rites. Many of their kings would adhere to customs of the peoples and whatnot. So like the Seleucids in Mesopotamia, Egyptian culture obviously being its making appearance in Egypt or the Ptolemies. And you have to also wonder, you know, were these peoples, let's say in Egypt, for example, were Greeks and Egyptians, or immigrant Greeks and local Egyptians living side by side? This seems to be the case. I mean, there was some level of coexistence, and oftentimes their realms overlapped, but they seem to have kept to their own selves a little bit more than what we were thinking of. However, what does change is that once you get to the upper part of the socioeconomic ladder, in the case of prominent members of these local communities, this sort of Hellenization process was more incentivized, consciously or otherwise, by the monarchies that ruled over them. The learning of Greek languages, the adoption of literary culture, reading the likes of Homer, Thucydides, Herodotus, that became much more prevalent in these communities, be they, for example, Jewish, be they in Mesopotamia, maybe the elite culture of Egypt. And we also, one maybe a good case example of this is the prevalence of double names. So this phenomenon is where you see oftentimes individuals living in these Hellenistic kingdoms that take on two names that they identify with. The first one of these names is typically Greek in origin. I mean, they're almost stereotypically Greek in some cases. There is also the personal name. Now, this is where you're going to be more attuned to what your culture, your birth culture was like. So if you're Egyptian, it might be, you know, Sinmonthis. It might be whereas your Greek name could be Apollonia. That's a good example right there. The difference between the two is that the personal name is almost used exclusively in the household, in the spheres of that community, your local primarily, going back to this case of the Egyptians, the local Egyptian community. But when you talk about economic document or economic transactions, documents relating to that, political and legal representation, this Greek name is what's used. And that implies that there is a certain level of emphasis on the value of being recognized as among the Greek community. In Egypt, it's also more complicated based on the fact that there's a terminology in the taxation referring to Greeks, Persians, Egyptians. It's not really as much as an ethnic identifier. It really is more of like a tax bracket of sorts. There were Egyptians who were classified as Hellenes, to use their terminology, so they got special privileges. But clearly there's a sort of a social incentive to become recognized as part of that Greek community. This is one of the key contributing factors that led to problems in Judea during the early 2nd century BC, where you have this sort of Hellenizing elite, contrasting with the more traditional conservative element of Judea and Jerusalem in particular. So you going back to my as a, kind of using as an example here of what this may look like. In Ptolemaic Egypt during the second century, there was a cavalry officer named Dryden and his wife Senmonthis. We have their an extensive record of their archives that date, you know, for a couple of generations, so it's an invaluable source to get an idea. Dryden had married this an Egyptian woman named Senmonthis. They were relatively well off, being members of the cavalry corps of Ptolemy's armies. And we see that Senmonthis adopted the name Apollonia. Now, as I mentioned before, Apollonia appears in documents relating to the management of the estate. So that's where legal documents, economic, but also in the way she also ran a what is basically a loan shark business, charging usurious rates. And she would also use her name Apollonia. But when communicating with her daughters, she exclusively used the name Senmonthis. Her daughters also followed the similar protocol. She had four daughters with Dryden, and all of them had these double name phenomenons. But then by the third generation, you have it where there's only the Egyptian name. So it does reveal that there is value in being presented as Greek, in identifying, being part of the gymnasium, the social political life. But it oftentimes was not a state-enforced policy. It was not something that was consciously enforced by the kings. I mean, there are a few claiming examples, like, again, with the Maccabees, the author of the Book of Maccabees tried articulating that Antiochus IV Epiphanes of the Seleucid Empire tried forcibly converting the Jews and turning the Temple of Jerusalem into a Temple of Zeus. But it clearly there was a lot more. It was an impartial process. And we do, though, see a lot of these elements proliferate in the elite rather than the day-to-day laborers, your peasants. As I mentioned, life went on. This is something that is consistent in our sources, but clearly there would have been changes. I mean, you know, being an Egyptian peasant, the Nile continues to flood. You pay your taxes to the king. If he's Greek or Egyptian, you're still owing taxes. So for them, that was less of a concern. But we do also see certain movements that may be construed as anti-Greek, such as the Great Revolt of Egypt, which ravaged Ptolemaic Egypt from about 204 to the 180s BC. So yeah, that's about the extent of it. I mean, there's a lot more nuance to this. I'm trying to encapsulate it, but that is essentially the process of Hellenization from your day-to-day perspective here. And I hope I've not gone in a too roundabout way of explaining it.
That's all a great explanation, I think, of kind of that middle merchant class and how they're really the epicenter of this active Hellenization process. And like I mentioned earlier, I also want to point out that over in Iran, I've talked a lot about on History of Persia, how Susa and Persepolis were cities in a very loose sense. That's really starts to change in this period too. There's the Greek and Macedonian drive to import the polis as a less of a system of government like it was in the classical period, because of course now everything's under these big empires. But as a social structure, the Greek style urban environment was very important to a lot of the immigrant settlers who came in as soldiers and their families arrived in the various empires that popped up. And that is where we get a lot of those cities developing in southern Iran for the first time. And some of those, like Istakhr, will become very, very important as time goes on. But one of the other things I wanted to hear from you about was how intentional and conscious was this process from a top-down sort of perspective? Obviously, we can just see how in our own lives, how culture can change on a on-the-ground level on a day-to-day basis without us ever really thinking about it in the moment. You know, one day you don't have a cell phone, then you do have a cell phone, and then the iPhone comes out, and now all of a sudden everybody has full-time access to the internet forever, and it's a terrible thing for everybody involved except for podcasts, which you should absolutely keep and are the only good thing on the internet. We swear. but you know, how intentional was the process of importing Hellenistic culture into these new societies?
Well, what we can find is that clearly, as I've sort of made a point of mentioning, that there doesn't seem to be any hardline legalistic explanations like you must convert, you must learn the Greek language, you must be this. But clearly there was a lot of favoritism expressed towards Greek culture over non-Greek culture. I mean, when you look at the prevalence of certain names, and I'll take a step back to this after I give this whole explanation. When you see the prevalence of names in the administrative class, they're almost overwhelmingly Greek. I mean, the king's friends are almost overwhelmingly probably going to be Greco-Macedonian. That doesn't mean that there weren't important members that were maybe Egyptian or Mesopotamian or Iranian. It was more so, I mean, maybe as far as we know, these Greek names might actually be the part of the double name system that is used. But the emphasis on what is more cultural affinity is more the case than not. Now, of course, we must understand here, it is a practicality and it must be understood that to properly rule kingdoms and empires that are predominantly not sharing your culture, that you have taken over with a small body of a military organization that is, you know, Greek in origin or ethnicity or whatever it might be you're describing it as, you're going to have to accommodate to local traditions and customs. There's no way, two ways about it. Alexander was at the forefront of this when he took over the Persian Empire, and that got a lot of flack. But quickly we see in the successive empires of the Ptolemies, the Seleucids, this was something you could not ignore. In the Ptolemaic case, they had clear precedents to follow. They had to work out arrangements with the local Egyptian priestly class that had been a major part of Egyptian life for thousands of years, as were the models and institutions of the pharaoh, which was so integral to the political framework of Egypt. This involved the participation in rituals and ceremonies, in paying homage to temples of gods that were local. Let's say I will sponsor the temple of Ptah in Memphis. Now, if we're kind of bring it to a more Iranian or history of Persia focus, the Seleucids are pretty famous, or at least are most represented with their adoption and honoring of Mesopotamian customs. The city of Babylon continued to be a prominent fixture in the Seleucid Empire many centuries after Alexander had conquered it. The kings themselves would play major parts in escorting the god Marduk during the famous New Year's festival, which took place approximately end of March, early April of each year. It's an elaborate ceremony, involves some sort of ritual humiliation. We know that based on the famous Antiochus cylinder, which is almost identical to the Cyrus cylinder instituted by Cyrus the Great a few centuries prior, where he is expressing how he is adhering to the expected notions of what it is to be like to be a Babylonian king. He has restored the walls of Azida, and he has taken the sacred oil and all that good stuff. Clearly, he's trying to show himself as a legitimate ruler following Babylonian custom. And I think an interesting example of this is Antiochus III famously received the cloak of Nebuchadnezzar II, gifted to him by the Babylonian priests, and that's making him both literally and symbolically the heir of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Now, we have, though, as I mentioned, that sort of favoritism expressed. Using the Seleucids as the example, that prominence of these development of these cities, the importation of the polis as the model, Babylon was certainly was doted upon, and that was, you know, something that was expressed, but we also see that the Seleucids had no problem putting their stamp over Mesopotamia and giving more weight to the nearby city of Seleucia on the Tigris to the north. We have evidence that either directly or by way of tax incentivizations, the Seleucids encouraged immigrants from the city of Babylon to Seleucia, which caused a drop in overall population of the city. most of the administrative and eventually economic life centered around Seleucia, not in Babylon. And eventually, Pliny the Elder, by the first century AD or late first century, early second century, describes Babylon as an effective ghost town in comparison to the glory days of centuries prior. And that is in no small part to the Seleucid mindset and models. They clearly wanted that Greek stamp, or at least their dynastic stamp, upon the landscape. In that sense, I mean, they clearly had no problems with oppressing the local peoples when they needed to. They would plunder temples belonging to local gods when they needed money. They didn't often do that for Greek gods. They did sometimes, but then it got a lot of backfire from their Greek constituents. And when you compare the Seleucids to their Persian predecessors, they were clearly fixated on the Eastern Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean, back to that Greek world. They were trying to attract people to come from the Greek mainland, scientists, scholars, philosophers. That is who was promoted. You have a few weird cases here and there, such as Berossus, the Babylonian scholar who wrote a history of Babylon and the mythology of it, borrowing Greek ideas, but there is that clear emphasis on cultural aspects that are, you know, defined as Greek. So in that sense, there is not a to summarize everything, there doesn't seem to be a clear-cut policy of we must make this region more Greek. Being a Greek made it more valuable because it was more culturally similar. We could probably assert authority more, but there was no realistic way that they could actually implement this program, and it was a gradual acculturization over many centuries, and it was actually quite long lasting because clearly, I mean, even into the new millennium, we have this evidence of a strong Greek culture, a Greek speaking class in places like Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, down to the 3rd and 4th centuries AD. Same with Babylonia and Mesopotamia, long after the Parthians had taken it over. But it clearly made a lasting mark, and that is no small part from the policies of these rulers.
I guess to make a historical comparison, it's more cultural prejudice and preference than the Achaemenids ever put on, but slightly less formalized than what we get to later with, like, the caliphates not forcibly converting anybody, but just making your life a living tax hell until you convert to Islam. You did bring up Berossus, which seems like a good time to switch over the topic to, you know, who and what are our sources for the Hellenistic period, and why do I routinely feel like I have less details to work with in the East than I do in the Achaemenid period, when I'm already have spent the past 5 years complaining about how I don't have any sources.
Oh boy, you're in for a treat. So in the long and short of it, with the Hellenistic period is, to be put it blunt, very poorly documented compared to classical Greece of the time of Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War, and eventually the rise of the Roman Empire and the late of the Civil War era with Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, etc. You have a few key players. The most famous of these is the historian Polybius of Megalopolis, an Achaean statesman of the 2nd century BC, who became a Roman hostage and friend of the family of descendants of Scipio Africanus. He was taken as a hostage, wrote a monumental history of the Mediterranean world, essentially from the First Punic War down to the destruction of Carthage and Corinth in 146. Now, in that time frame, his goal was to explain to a Greek audience how did the Romans conquer the known world in only a period of about 50 years or so, give or take. Now, in that, he spends a large amount of time. Polybius is probably, outside of Thucydides, the single best ancient historian you could ask for. Extremely thorough, rigorous, very detailed with his sources, and very, you know, not impartial, but certainly is very clear about where he gets his information from. And has a clear understanding of causality in events, and is extremely advanced in his perception of what is history and, you know, whatnot. Unfortunately, we have very little of him. We really only have the first few books that survive in their entirety. The rest are very fragmented, but we can rely on the likes of Livy, the Augustan historian who wrote a monumental history on the Roman Empire, on the history of Rome, down to the days of Augustus. Now, Polybius talks a lot about the kingdoms of the Hellenistic world, and mostly in that period falling between, let's say, 220 to about 146. That's when he really delves into the likes of Antiochus III, Ptolemy IV and V, Philip V of Macedon. Outside of that period, you do have, at the beginning, the likes of, you know, Diodorus of Sicily, who wrote a monumental history, which is very fragmented, especially after Alexander's reign. You also have a few other key sources like Plutarch, who wrote a series of biographies, which only of them have two of them based on Hellenistic rulers, Pyrrhus of Epirus and Demetrius Polyarchides, both shortly after Alexander's death. So we are missing quite a span of time, but he does talk about them here and there. The historian Justin, who epitomized an earlier history by a man called Pompeius Trogus, a Gallo-Roman historian who wrote a comprehensive history of the world, basically covering from everything from Britain all the way to India and the Greco-Bactrian period. Unfortunately, it's very abbreviated and very messy. And that's basically the key figures we can rely on for the Hellenistic period. I mean, it's unfortunate for that area. It gets even worse when you get to the eastern territories. Of course, actually, I need to take a step back. You do also have some curious non-Greek sources, the most famous of these being the Book of Maccabees and the religious tradition of the Jews. The Maccabean Revolt primarily focused on the wars against Antiochus IV and his successors and the rise of the Hasmonean state. Obviously gives us a lot of insight into the relation between, a lot of insight from a very colored source about the insights relationship between the ruling Greek Greco-Macedonian kings and the non-Greeks, I think in this case the Jews. When you go more east, it becomes even poorer. Mediterranean-based authors tend to be focused, well, on the Mediterranean. Rome is obviously the main player that serves as a lot of the focus, and what their interactions with these Hellenistic states through mainly conflict is what brings them back into the picture. But when you go anything past Mesopotamia, you are at a large loss. That's where you rely on figures like Justin, who did borrow from earlier texts, such as the historian Apollodorus of Artemita, who wrote a famous history called the Parthica. He was a Greek born and raised in Artemita, which is a city in Mesopotamia under the Parthian Empire. And he wrote quite a bit about the history of the rise of the Parthian state. This covers areas like Central Asia, even as far as northwestern India. And unfortunately, we have very limited sources unless these major figures like Antiochus go to these areas. So, for example, the period that covers the Greco-Bactrian kingdom, which is the breakaway state from the Seleucid Empire, established roughly in 246, but lasts down to the 145s, and the subsequent Indo-Greek kingdoms, which were established by Bactrian kings invading India in the late 180s. We have in total about 7 pages of sources on them, variously collected and very dubiously accurate. We barely know anything about them, and unfortunately, that's about what we're going to have to all expect. We have to rely more on coins, inscriptions, and whatever archaeological finds we have. But the problem is with a lot of Central Asia is that it's politically unstable, especially in Afghanistan, where this was a hotbed of a lot of our evidence was coming from. Places like the city of Ikhanum, which produced tons of research materials. It looks like the battlefields of Verdun. It's been absolutely torn apart by political insurgents and the Taliban looking to loot and destroy and take to sell on the black market. So Heaven help us if we find anything else. And the Parthians as well. I mean, they're, despite being this omnipresent force in for much of Hellenistic and Roman history, have only a handful of inscriptions that survive. So really, it's a bit, we're looking at a rough picture, and we really need to rely on what we have and fiddle around with what we've got to try to paint somewhat of a clear picture. But when it comes to the East, it's a wing and a prayer at best.
Well, there you have it, listeners. If any of you frequent black market antiques shows, please send me the next piece of suspicious Greek or Aramaic papyrus you come across. But you did mention coinage, and why exactly do I have to relive grad school trauma and talk so much about numismatics to cover, quite frankly, the Hellenistic period and the entirety of the Parthian period? Where does all of this importance for coinage in historical writing today come from?
Well, strap yourselves in, everybody. It's time to learn about numismatics. So coins, in the broad sense, and this is as described, and I've borrowed heavily from the famous numismatist Frank Lee Holt. Coins are one of the first mass-produced objects in the history of the world. They are incredibly durable. There was many tens of hundreds and possibly millions of these things produced over lifetimes of kings. They were circulated and are generally durable, being well. Let me rephrase that. The ones that are not made of precious metal tend to survive longer by virtue of the fact that nobody really wants them to melt them down. But they survive quite well in the soil comparatively to papyrus or leather skins, to written paper materials. And they oftentimes serve us as like a little compact disc of information. So we have an idea of not only the names of kings, which could provide us a checklist of people to follow and compare to our sources, but they can expand upon maybe kings we didn't know about that aren't mentioned in our minuscule sources, which is for comparison of the kings of Greco-Bactria and the Indo-Greeks. I don't have the exact number of confirmed, but we have in our sources about give or take 10 to 12 named rulers of that kingdom. With coinage, this climbs to well over 40. So being able to use these coins, which were which seem to be buried or dug up primarily in coin hoards, these are, you know, deposits of these coinages that are scattered all over the countryside in bones and urns, buried, half hidden. Originally, it was taken as a way, Central Asia in particular has an abundance of coinage. The idea was, wow, did the Greeks really ramp up their coin production? And in some sense, that is true. The coins of Greco-Bactria and the Indo-Greeks are often viewed as a higher quality, more technically proficient. That's more of an aesthetic judgment value. But having seen these in person, they are very impressive. But the problem is with coin hoards is that you can't necessarily correlate it with monetary production, because it also, when somebody buries a coin hoard and does not come back for it, usually that means the person died. This indicates times of instability, of periods of unrest. So if you see an abundance of a particular king that pops up in coin hoards, more than likely you're going to have it where either during his reign or very immediately afterwards, this was a time of great instability, of war, famine, whatever it might be. And besides, you know, a lot of Greco-Bactrian and Central Asian numismatics, there was a tendency to use coins and coin portraits of kings to paint these often ridiculously fictitious dynastic stories. I mean, the famous pioneer in this regards, W.W. Tarn in the mid 20th century. He wrote the famous comprehensive history of the Bactrian and Indian Greeks. And this involves the Parthians, of course, too, and also the successors as well, like the Kushans and later the Sassanids. But he was very liberal in how he applied these coins, where he took the physiognomy, the appearance of these kings, and wrote these entire personalities. Like if one looked more stern or was had a smile on his face, oh, he was much more affable, and somehow he was married based upon the beads of this coin type to this other dynast who was secretly the daughter of Antiochus III. It's really questionable behavior. But now, as time has gone on, we have now reassessed these coins and looked at other ways we can determine what they mean. If a coin has a die strike over it, so that means it's been overstruck, whereby a later king strikes over a previous king. Well, then we probably know that this is the chronology of who ruled in this area. If there are misspellings in the coins, then clearly that means that there might be a need to mass produce these objects. Is there the quality of the craftsmen going down? Are they speaking less Greek and it's becoming sloppier? It's very possible. But there's more to be drawn from it. And unfortunately, as you will clearly no doubt get to know through Trevor's works, sometimes all you're going to do is, you know, you're going to hear the expression based upon the coin finds, because there's really no other evidence for these kings besides these coins. And you have to spend so much time looking at them and taking the imagery away from them to really get even a fraction of the picture of what you have in the likes of the Mediterranean world during the Roman Empire, which has its own problems during certain periods. So imagine a time frame of almost, let's say, from the death of Alexander from the Achaemenid period all the way down to the rise of Islam, where you have this sort of gray zone where nothing is really written down in comparison. And it's, you know, in that case, coins being the disposable, being disposed of and produced in such huge quantities, ends up being the fixture point which we can assign much of our history from.
Yes. If that sounds exciting to you listening out there, strap in, because we are going to have whole civil wars that are based primarily around, well, there's two kings minting coins at the same time, so they must be brothers fighting one another.
Oh, of course.
And we're going to keep doing that into the Sassanid period, because that is how scarce the sources will be for a while. Now, the other big hallmark of, I think, popular conversation and research on the Hellenistic period is religion, and the sometimes bizarre synchronism between Greek religion and the various local pantheons and cults they ran into after Alexander's conquests. My master's degree advisor had several papers written about Serapis, the Ptolemy's completely new made-up god that they created just for themselves.
How organic. So to kind of take a step back here, when we refer to syncretism, that's really the broad, in general usage, it's referring to a sort of fusion or adoption of certain religious iconography from different religious groups. Maybe I'm trying not to step over myself here, where you have this sort of identification that can be broadly perceived as the same god, but clearly now is the characteristics are being carried across into different pantheons. And this can go both ways. The most famous example you had just mentioned is Serapis. This was a conscious developed god created on behalf, very likely on the Ptolemaic government under Ptolemy I. He's sort of an amalgamation between Zeus, Hades, and of course the Egyptian god Osiris. The idea in theory was, actually, there was also, of course, the sister wife Isis, who is an amalgamation of the god, Egyptian goddess Isis, but also Hera and Aphrodite. They were often viewed together. Now, the idea for the Ptolemies was that, hey, we're going to be creating something that can maybe, you know, unify the peoples of their Egyptians and Greeks alike. They worship the same god. Isn't that great and wonderful? Well, it didn't really catch on with the Egyptians. They continued to worship much of their traditional gods in the same fashion and weren't really too keen on adopting Serapis. But in the Greek world, this was an explosion of popularity. These cults, as you maybe want to call them, were widely imported to the Mediterranean, especially in areas that were controlled by the Ptolemies. they were taken in. They were often viewed as distinct from the likes of, you know, Hades, Zeus, Aphrodite, Hera, but they were incorporated into the traditional pantheon and religious life of the Greek world. And this also continued extremely heavily in the Roman world as well, where these Eastern cults become so prominent. Of course, you have examples like Mithra, the cult of Mithra, for example. Now, going back to the likes of Herodotus, I mean, there is this constant need to identify Greek gods with their local variations. I mean, Herodotus has the famous story of the Greek gods traveling to Egypt, taking on the forms and, you know, hiding out there. So that's why there's like, oh, you know, we recognize clearly this must be the case. These gods are the same, even though they're, you know, mildly different. This phenomenon continued in the time of Alexander. He associated the god Amun-Ra with Zeus, where you have this now new combination Zeus-Amun. Also the god Melkart, the Phoenician god Melkart with Heracles. But this really begins to ramp up in the Hellenistic period, where you have these Greek immigrant communities living alongside these Eastern religious cult or religious practices and customs. And conversely, you have kind of a two-way transfer of artistic motives, of ideas. As I mentioned, Serapis was sort of the one-way variation of it, where the Egyptian elements were adopted mainly by Greeks. But we do have many examples of Greek visual motifs becoming kind of a standard as part of the religious ideas and customs of other peoples. My case study is always Heracles. The famous strongman, demigod, drunkard, whatever you want to refer to him as, is easily the greatest hero in the Greek tradition. He was super popular amongst warrior kings based on his martial virtues, as a monster slayer, as a tamer of civilization, and he was extremely far traveled. For example, we find him, as I mentioned, they started identifying him with Heracles Melkart in the Phoenician lands and Carthage. Hannibal Barca, in his coinage when he's minting from Spain, uses what is identifiable as Heraclean motifs. These are the thick beard, the heavyset musculature, nudity, the club, and the lion skin. These are all common fixtures. When you travel east of that, you have in Iran the Zoroastrian war god Verethragna, who is oftentimes associated. There's a famous example that came from Seleucia on the Tigris, which has the names of both inscribed on there, and also the famous Behistun Heracles, which was put near the Behistun monument, which you are also lovingly familiar with. Most curiously is his prominence in Central Asia and India. I mean, he was very popular among the Bactrian kings. We have his image on coinage, the adoption of titles, very similar. But in addition to the image of royal iconography, he eventually becomes Heracles Vajrapani. This is a syncretism between Heracles and the Buddhist Yakshi deity Vajrapani, who is the protector of the Buddha. This is not written in sources, but more explicitly in the artworks of the lands known as Gandhara, which is about northern Pakistan on the border of Afghanistan. You have an artistic flourishing which incorporates a lot of these mythological elements from Greece and Rome into traditional Indian forms of art. You have the presence of satyrs, maenads, ivy, things that are more traditionally associated with the Mediterranean world that are carried over into Indian storytelling. And Heracles is the most prominent of these. You oftentimes see these scenes of the Buddha's life where, you know, he is seated in one of his storytelling scenes, and sitting on his side or standing next to him is clearly the god Heracles, who is wielding his club, who has his lion skin, but he's clearly taking on the role as Vajrapani, the guardian of the Buddha, and uses similar weaponry. But there's some variations of that, but it is still that persistent identifiable feature that goes basically from Britain during the Roman Empire all the way to India at the time. So this syncretism is partially a conscious effort, but then also because people simply like associating with these elements. I mean, Greeks, as we obviously clearly found some sort of inspiration from local gods and deities, as did the local peoples from Greek deities. The question then becomes, you know, what do we identify as, you know, why would people choose these elements? There's a fantastic book by, I believe, Stephanie Langdon Hooper discussing terracotta figurines from Seleucid Babylonia, where you can see representations of goddesses such as what might be viewed as Aphrodite or Astarte. And it really becomes challenging to pick apart, okay, was this primarily intended to be Greek, or was this intended to be or was she clearly more intended to be in Aphrodite with Babylonian features, or Astarte with Greek features? We don't really know. And that's where part of the what I think is the most interesting aspect is sort of the identity and where people seem to find themselves as, you know, how can you simply identify someone based upon what god they worshipped? I mean, if someone visits a temple, they may not view them as that official deity. They may just see them as a avatar of their own. There is a famous temple in Ikonum in Bactria. There is a temple which is believed to be of Kybele or Zeus. And it really can go either way. Someone might see it as Kybele. Someone might see it as Zeus. Someone might see it as a local Zoroastrian god like Anahita. But it really is a case of, you know, how much do we have to take in the value of, are they really understanding that they're taking on a foreign concept, or are they just taking parts? Do they just like out of aesthetic value? But there is clearly a transformation in these religious identities and how it's expressed. And this kind of leads to what Gustav Droysen was mainly interested in, was the rise of Christianity based upon the syncretism between what he viewed as like the rational Hellenistic thought and the religious tradition of the Old Testament and the intellectual culture of Judaism. And that eventually gave birth to the rise of Christianity as sort of this fusion between the two. Now, that again is under serious controversy, but there are quite a bit of truths to what that perception was. And I think it's one of my favorite aspects of learning about the Hellenistic period, just seeing how these cultures adapted one of each other's ideas.
Excellent. Yeah. And we will be seeing plenty of that as I kill off many Seleucid kings, because that's when I like to talk about the religion episodes. And if anybody likes this idea of syncretism, you can go back and listen to my episode on Anahita and the development of the triune triarchy of divinities under Artaxerxes II, where I talk a lot about what I call the Ishtar continuum of goddesses, where somehow, some way, there is a goddess in every culture from India to Italy that gets identified with Aphrodite or Ishtar or Nanea or Anahita in some capacity. Derek, the one thing I did want to follow up with on the religion question that you may not have an answer for is, have you run into anything about the Orphic mystery cult spreading during the Hellenistic period?
The mystery cults thing is something I'm not terribly familiar with. I have been doing some reading. There's I don't have the book right in front of me, but it does delve into the likes of the Eleusinian mysteries and the Orphic cults. These cultic rites apparently continue to be pretty popular down mainly in the Greek, in the Greek mainland primarily. I don't really find much evidence of this continuing in Ptolemaic Egypt or the Seleucid Empire. Perhaps that is due mainly because the interest of research is focused on those syncretized deities. But I imagine that down to the Roman period, these cults were continuing to be prospering. But the Orphic one, I am not as familiar with personally.
All right, that's perfectly fine. They appear to be a major influence on the Zervanist movement in Zoroastrianism, which we first get hints of with, I don't remember which lost Greek author in the mid-4th century after Alexander, and becomes very important later on. I just wanted to know if there was anything specific you had run into about them.
Yeah, I'm afraid not. But now, you know, after all these, you know, after the years of doing this, I continue to find more and more of these little elements that pop through. So for those who may be listening from my show, you might have a bonus episode coming along in the future now that I'm realizing it is.
Yeah, it is not very well developed on the Zoroastrian end at that point, or at least it's not very popular. But it is the reason that I wrote the article on Kronos, the god of time, for That is all I've got for us in terms of questions. Derek, is there anything else you wanted to add about the Hellenistic Age?
Well, I mean, it's in an exhaustive period. I mean, obviously, Trevor is going to be focused primarily on Iran and the Persia, the ancient region of Asia and Persia in general. However, if you're remotely interested, we will also be covering, I'm sure, topics he will also be able to do far more with far more skill and brevity, maybe. The Pontic Kingdom, the Mithridates of Pontus, Cappadocia, Karakene, all these breakaway states that formed in what is Iran and Mesopotamia. First off, good luck and trying to explain that mess after the Seleucid Civil Wars. But if you're interested to find out about the period in general and kind of get an idea of outside of the Seleucids, consider following me. It's called the Hellenistic Age Podcast. I produce episodes about once a month, but also I have episodes involving interviews, guest lectures, that sort of thing. You can find me on virtually every podcast platform and just by searching up the Hellenistic Age Podcast. And I'd like to thank you, Trevor, once again for inviting me. I'm a huge fan of the show, and we've been kind of parallel living each other for the past 6 years or so now, and that's kind of horrifying to think it's been 6 years already. But I'm really looking forward to see how you approach the period, because I rarely look backwards, so I want to see how maybe you might tackle it a lot better than what I did.
Yes, well, thank you so much for coming on, and I am looking forward to getting deeper into the Hellenistic Age on my end and taking the show through all of the ups and downs that are Seleucid and Parthian history as time goes forward. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.